We're speaking with Marcus Carson, who's a senior research fellow at the Stockholm Environment Institute in Sweden. He'll be speaking in Kalamazoo on Friday, November 4th at noon in Sandgren Hall, and the presentation sponsored by Western's Interdisciplinary Climate Change Working Group and the Institute for the Environment and Sustainability. Dr. Carson, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Why are we watching the Arctic so closely?
There are a couple of reasons, I guess, and I should clarify my specialty is actually it's sociology, as opposed to I'm not a climate scientist, but we are particularly concerned with looking at how how humans interact with these ecosystems, and that's part of the reason that we're concerned about the Arctic. The Arctic is changing due to climate change at roughly twice the pace as the rest of the planet. And that could have some serious consequences. And some of those consequences we're beginning to see already.
Why is the Arctic so sensitive to climate change and the people in the Arctic?
Yeah, well, part of the reason it's sensitive is because of the function that it serves for the global climate. When you get snow melting, sea ice disappearing, it reduces the reflectivity of the region there. And so you get a feedback loop that begins to heat up much, much more rapidly. So for example, the temperature is moving up at roughly double the rate of the global temperatures. And if you've followed any of the discussions in Alaska over the last couple of years, there have been times they've had difficulty running the Iditarod. There are areas where buildings that are based on permafrost, on this permanently frozen ground, are collapsing because temperatures are going up very rapidly. So they're seeing the effects of climate change in very concrete, observable, and disruptive ways.
And what are the human impacts on those who live in the Arctic, the Inuit, for example?
Sure. Well, for native peoples in the Arctic, their way of life that tends to be very closely coupled to nature becomes, in many cases, much more difficult. For example, in Greenland, the ice, for the Inuit in Greenland, the ice is a platform for hunting. And as that ice disappears, it gets more and more difficult for them to carry out their activities. The same is true in some areas of Alaska, where the sort of the means of transportation that's dependent on snow and ice is changing. And it makes it much more difficult to carry out some of the activities.
You're going to be speaking here in Kalamazoo about what people can do on the local level to impact this global phenomenon that we're encountering. And, I think a lot of people, when they hear about climate change and its impact on various parts of the world, there's a tendency to, throw up your hands and say, well, what could I possibly do about it? I know I've personally felt that way, but you seem to feel that people can act individually to have an effect on this.
Yeah, I think we can. Climate change is a particularly challenging problem because it's even if its consequences are pretty visible now and fairly dramatic in places like the Arctic, the causes are unusually dispersed. And, it's everything from us driving our cars to especially things like producing electricity by burning coal, which is one of the worst culprits in the U.S. And so there are a range of things that we can do, but more important than doing them individually, I would say that some of the CO2 pollution that we produce is because the systems that we operate in are heavy on fossil fuels, and those we have to change together. And that's where the politics comes in, so things like the president's Clean Power Plan, or the EPA's Clean Power Plan, there was an effort to begin to systematically and relatively fast begin to draw down the carbon emissions. Those are really, really important for being able to reduce our impacts there. And those happen through the political system.
What can individuals, though, or local communities do you think that would assist this effort?
Yeah, well, I think there are a number of things. Part of the reason I'm a Kalamazoo native. I grew up there, went to Kalamazoo College, and am coming back because, in part, because I think this election is very important. And the two parties stand at opposite ends of the spectrum, with one party being led by somebody who claims that climate change is a Chinese hoax, and another who's sort of embracing climate change as a serious problem that we need to do something about. Probably not going to affect us dramatically for the next 10 or 20 years, but like a lot of people, I have kids, and I'm concerned about what happens to the world that they inherit. So I think ultimately the elections coming up are really important. Our congressman from Kalamazoo is somebody who used to say that climate change was a serious problem, and in the last few years he's sort of lost track of the science in what it said, and begins to put him more in the denier category, that he denies the consensus of the science that says that these things are changing. And it's not just computer models, it's actually what we're observing in places like Alaska and other parts of the Arctic. And he sits in a very important committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee, that chairs it, and so has a lot of control over what gets done, both at the national level, but how that filters back to the state, that enables us to actually tackle the main causes of climate change, which are these systemic issues like making electricity by burning coal.
There's this concept that's come up fairly recently, the Anthropocene. Could you explain that?
Yeah. The idea used to be that there are so few of us and we're so small, how could we possibly impact the planet? And there's a term that's been bouncing around. I think Andy Revkin, who's the New York Times environmental reporter, first coined it. But to sort of name an era where there are enough of us and our activities are magnified enough by our technologies that we really do have a huge impact on the planet. So there's actually a big scientific discussion about sort of how would you define the Anthropocene and when did it start? And they're looking at everything from the side effects of burning coal to fallout from nuclear tests as the way to sort of mark the beginning of that. It's a fairly arcane discussion scientifically, but I think the message comes through really clear, and that is that that we're having a dramatic impact on our planet. Some of it is very localized, and some of it's very global, as is the case with climate.
Something else that's been talked about recently is, you know, whether or not we've reached the tipping point at which time whatever we're doing, we've gone beyond the point of no return, I guess, is the best way to put it with climate change. Do you think we have? Do you think we have? And if so, what, if anything, can be done about it?
Yeah, you know, the real problem with tipping points is that we won't know that we've gone past them until they're behind us. It's kind of like driving off of one of those bridges that's been washed out. With those kinds of situations, particularly with the Arctic, for example, when we get to the point where we have summers that are free of sea ice, or where the Greenland ice sheet collapses, there won't be any putting the genie back in the bottle. Those changes will be rolling along. It's possible that we are past those already, and we just haven't been able to figure that out yet. So we need to be especially cautious because the processes that we're setting in motion are sort of run over longer time frames than we're accustomed to watching, and they're happening on a much larger scale than we're generally equipped to monitor. But once we've gone past those, we could get ourselves into real trouble, and so it only makes sense to try to stay on the inside of those tipping points instead of going over.
You know, the international conferences and meetings that have tried to grapple with, you know, the issue of climate change have been rather contentious and, to be honest, don't seem to have accomplished very much. Would you agree with that? And if so, what can be done about that?
I would say, one, yes, they've been rather contentious, just like the politics of sort of dealing with energy here. And energy really is the source of, or energy production is the source of most of our our greenhouse gas emissions. But they actually have accomplished quite a bit, and considering that it's over 190 countries that have to come to agreement about reducing their climate impacts, and that there's a process that's been underway and was agreed to and set in motion in record time, I think we're actually seeing progress at a scale that that we've never seen before. And it's especially important that we continue to build on that. And the U.S. obviously was part of that, although that's a bit under threat right now.
You mentioned the possibility that in not the not too distant future that the North Pole could be just open water, not ice. That's led to speculation that there might be a gold rush, so to speak, to get the oil that's thought to be underneath the polar cap.
Yes, indeed.
And that's led apparently to fears that there might actually be armed conflict, since a number of countries claim that. Russia claims it, Canada claims it, the U.S. claims it's free for everyone. Can this lead to conflict, perhaps even armed conflict?
It certainly could lead to conflict, and that, I guess, is the side effect that would be perhaps not a surprise. The more worrisome side effect, though, is that we might be chasing after the very thing that we are driving the climate change forward with. The greatest irony would be if we're burning fossil fuels, driving the disappearance of the ice that reflects back the heat from the sun. And our response to that disappearance of ice would be to go after more fossil fuels and burn them as well. And it's not just the sea ice. We also have a pile of ice sitting on top of Greenland. And you may have seen the news in the last 6 months or so, but the axis of the Earth is actually shifting as a result of the loss of mass on Greenland. So if you put a piece of gum on a top and spun it, you would see a wobble. And if you change the position of that gum, it would change the wobble. And essentially what's happening with our planet, our entire planet, is that wobble is shifting because of the loss of mass. Most of the sea level rise that comes from the loss of ice in Greenland will happen in the southern hemisphere, because the gravity from that ice actually pulls water toward it. But we have a lot of ice on the opposite side of the planet, that and the water from that will be coming in our direction. So we have these sort of tipping points that in the long run are every bit as scary as the threat of renewed conflict. And I guess in sociology there's a, as in most of the social sciences, there's a discussion about keeping your science and your politics separate. And what I think we see here is a monumental problem that science has been able to identify, and quite a variety of different branches of science have been able to independently verify, so that we have a quite good understanding of what's going on. But what's been difficult is that on the policy side, on the politics side, we've had a hard time getting people to come together. And what disturbs me as a native of Michigan and Kalamazoo is the way that we see a split within one of the parties, where Republicans who are not in office actually are fairly concerned about climate change. And you see a number of movements with Republicans trying to figure out market-based solutions for tackling that problem. And yet the ones in office or running for office have turned into climate change deniers. So in Kalamazoo, we have Fred Upton, who used to think that climate change was a problem. And it's hard to believe that the evidence has changed his mind, but I suspect political pressure has. He's blocking the kind of response that we need to begin to deal with this more effectively. Got a guy like Paul Clements who's running against him, who, as I understand it, got into the race because he was so concerned about climate change, and so it would actually take climate change and make that, among other things, a high priority. Same thing at the presidential level, where Donald Trump is focused on bringing coal back, and coal needs to be eliminated regardless of climate change. It kills people at every step in the process, whether it's mining, transport, or burning it. And we have politicians at the state level in Michigan who are challenging the president's clean power plan. They're even challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's regulations to reduce the emissions of mercury, which also kills people, and especially people who are in the vicinity of these coal-burning power plants. So we have a number of threats, some of them potentially, conventional military threats. And we have these other kinds of threats where there are tipping points, where the climate regulation function of the Arctic could collapse. And right now, what's blocking our response in the U.S. is sort of a political bifurcation where elected Republicans find it very difficult to do anything about this or are leading the opposition, and Democrats are trying to grapple with it. It doesn't need to be that way. 10 years ago, climate change was a bipartisan issue, and we need to get back to that. But I think the start is for people to take action next week to look at the positions that people are taking on climate change and support people who are prepared to take fairly assertive action.
Given all that, would you consider yourself an optimist or a pessimist on the ultimate outcome of all of this?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be pessimistic about. But I'm hardwired as an optimist. It doesn't help very much to be pessimistic. And I think given the progress that's been made on the political side, the progress that's been made globally, getting countries to come together around a plan that's not enough but is a pretty good start, and actually the progress being made in developing solar and other renewable energy, those things are really beginning to take hold in a whole new way. Those will produce the electricity we need, the energy independence that our country needs, and a lot of new economic opportunities for people to produce the technologies that make us independent and clean. So in that way, I think there's a lot also to be optimistic about, but we have to really engage for that potential to be realized.
Now, you've mentioned that you are from Kalamazoo. You graduated from Kalamazoo College. How did you end up all the way over there in Stockholm, Sweden?
Yeah, well, it's a long story, but to make it shorter, I worked in a number of different places around the U.S. I took a 3-month motorcycle trip in Europe and met a Swedish woman who we eventually married. And part of the deal we made when we got married is that it would be fair for us to live in both countries. So after a decade of living in Louisiana together with a couple of kids who were at the age where they needed to learn Swedish if they were going to learn it, my turn came. So we moved to Sweden to see how it would go. And that was 15 years ago.
It obviously agrees with you.
It's worked quite well, and I have a lot of chance with this Arctic work to stop through Chicago, Kalamazoo, and visit family. So it's a good mix.
Do you find that the Swedes and the other Scandinavians, the Finns, the Icelanders, the Norwegians, do they tend to, just because of their proximity, be more focused on the Arctic and climate change issues?
I think there's a bit more focus, although Sweden has not been extremely focused on the Arctic. But there's a culture here that is I think, more willing to trust science. And so the denial machine here is much weaker. And frankly, Sweden has been getting off of fossil fuels now for 40 years. So there's, I think, only about 3% of Sweden's electricity is produced using fossil fuels. Most of it's hydropower and nuclear. So the electricity system is pretty clean. But we've been at it for a long time here, and that makes the transition a lot easier than if you have to do it all of a sudden. There's another aspect of living in Sweden, two others that have come up in the in the presidential elections that I think might be interesting to people. One is that the healthcare system that I live in here is tax financed with private delivery. And what that means is that nobody here worries about their healthcare. It's not a perfect system. You know, there are some kinds of care where you have to wait for a little while, but you never have to worry about whether you're going to be able to pay for it. And my limited experience has been extremely good. The other, interestingly enough, is that I did my PhD here in Sweden, and the university system is tuition free. You have books and you know, living expenses that you have to pay for, but the university system doesn't leave students saddled with debt. And so there's my kids or you know, the kids of the person who works at the 7-Eleven up the street have the same kind of opportunity to do studies at the university, regardless of their economic status. And when they finish, they don't finish. You can take out loans for those living expenses, but people don't finish with this sort of, I think in Michigan, the average debt for somebody coming out of college is in the $30,000 to $40,000 range. That's a lot of money to pay back. So there are things in the system here that work quite well that people have decided to do together. And they produce a lot of opportunity for people that that is not dependent on the family they were born into. So it's nice actually to see that a system like that actually works pretty well. And that's also cause for optimism.
And finally, as we draw to a close here, is there anything you would like to add or talk about that we haven't talked about yet?
Yeah, I guess, you know, this has been a long and difficult election season, I think. And I've seen a number of comments where people are saying, you know, I just want for this to be over. But I think we have a few more days to hang on and to really focus on content. And I think if you're concerned that climate change or issues like climate change might even be a problem, then it really makes sense for us to tackle those in a systematic way and to support in the election people who have committed themselves to grappling with those issues rather than trying to sweep them under the rug. Because the consequences of that will be long-term, and they will be very difficult to reverse if we get it wrong.
We've been speaking with Dr. Marcus Carson. He's a senior research fellow at the Stockholm Environment Institute in Sweden and a Kalamazoo native. He'll be speaking here at Western Michigan University on Friday, November 4th at noon in Sangren Hall. That's sponsored by Western's Interdisciplinary Climate Change Working Group and the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Dr. Carson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much. I appreciate you having me on.